Welcome to the Oldie Podcast. This is from our literary lunch with guest speakers recorded on the 23rd of January 2024 and kindly sponsored by Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. Our lunches are held monthly. Details and how to book can be found in our magazine and on the website www.theoldie.co.uk.
Our next speaker, Robert Harman, is one of our leading journalists as royal correspondent for first The Telegraph and then The Mail. He's a terrific reporter. If you go back and look at the footage of the tragic Notre Dame fire in 2019, the first people into the cathedral are President Macron and a very, very tall, distinguished-looking journalist, beautifully dressed, is Robert Harman. He just strode past security, so distinguished-looking, they thought he must be someone very important, which he is, and he is one of our leading royal biographies. He wrote three brilliant biographies of our late Queen, and he wrote the Boxing Day film, which many of you would have seen, Charles III, the coronation year. His latest book has completely dominated the headlines the last couple of weeks. His scoop about the late Queen being distressed about her childhood nickname being taken away by her grandchildren was so extraordinary that Robert managed to achieve the impossible. He made Prince Harry and Meghan Markle go completely silent. He is Robert Harman talking about Charles III, new king, new court, the inside story.
Thank you. Thank you, Harry. Thank you, everybody. Masterclass in how to get a punchline right, Roger. A high-risk punchline, and it's brilliant. Thank you all for coming. I was reminded today, actually, I thought on the way here, that as the new king prepares his list of new royal warrants, which we're told are in the offing, a matter of days, if not weeks, before we get those, I think there should be a royal warrant for the oldie. Purveyor of awards and common sense. Because, of course, Queen Camilla was here at your 2021 awards. You gave an award to the late Queen Elizabeth II.
She turned it down
very eloquently, didn't she? She said, "You're only as young as you feel," and she didn't feel she was up for one just yet. Maybe you could do a posthumous one, but I think Charles has heard it'd be a perfect candidate, to be honest.
Not old enough,
says Harry. he's proving to be a perfect illustration of the of your great catchphrase of the merits of having snap in one's celery. He very much does. Now, admittedly, he's off games this week. We send him our best wishes, as we do indeed to the Princess of Wales and to Sarah, Duchess of York. But what I found while I was writing my book on him was, and it's absolutely true today, is that he is thoroughly enjoying being king. He is that there is, as one of his great friend said to me, there is a newfound serenity about him. Now there is a sort of rather risible plot line in the Crown. I don't know how many of you watched the Crown, but in the last couple of series there is a sort of constant recurring theme that he's desperate. Prince of Wales is desperate to get his hands on the levers of power, and he keeps lobbying prime ministers and his mother and everybody else, saying, "Oh, come on, move aside. It's my turn." That's absolutely not what happened. In fact, it's the absolute reverse. I think one of the reasons that the late Queen's authority was completely undiminished right up to the very end was the fact that he was not in any way jostling for any sort of preferment. In fact, what I discovered was that ministers were constantly badgering him for meetings with his staff because they wanted to make plans. Government's always trying to make plans about everything. They wanted to make plans for a regency, and he did not want to know. He brushed it aside. He would not get involved in these things. It was absolutely a case of, the day will come, and until that day comes, the Queen is the Queen. And I think he as much as she does, deserves credit for the authority that she commanded right until the end. And so, you know, he's a happy monarch, and I think it's got to be quite pleasing to be able to disprove all those doomsters who are saying, you know, he's going to be a constitutional loose cannon, there's going to be a collapse in the popularity of the monarchy, and that simply hasn't happened. In my book, I go into, you know, what are the new things? People keep saying, what's new about this reign? Well, there are a lot of new things. Although monarchy is all about continuity. It's not a brand of toothpaste. It doesn't just change overnight. So overall, much of it's the same. But there are changes. I mean, I think we saw one just last week, actually. I mean, after many years of writing about royalty, I never thought I'd see the words enlarged prostate in a palace statement. There they were. Because, you know, he took the view, well, you know, if I can do some good by elaborating on my condition, and online searches for prostate treatment have gone up 139% in the last 5 days. Ergo, I think we can draw our own conclusions. Other changes. There's what one of his staff describes as an informal formality about the new reign. I think we saw it on day one when he flew down from Balmoral after the death of the Queen, stopped the car outside the palace gates, and got straight into the crowds there. And the very first person he met, he went out, arm outstretched, to shake her hand, and she said, "Can I give you a hug?" And no one would have asked the late monarch for a hug, and had they done, they wouldn't have got one. But he went, "Yeah, okay, of course." And I think that sort of, in many ways, that sums up the new approach. You see it in receptions, actually, at the palace now. There are no more greeting lines. Everything's slightly chaotic, but that's fine. You know, people in the old days used to be told to sort of stand in particular groups and wait to be spoken to. Now, everybody is sort of free range. And as he points out, yes, they've come to see me, but they've also come to see each other. It's certainly colder. He's always opening the windows, much to the distress of a lot of his staff, and indeed Queen Camilla, who quite likes things warm and cosy. So there are quite a few battles over the windows, but if you're ever wandering around a royal building, you wonder where the king is, look for the flapping curtains, because that's the room he's in. There will be no events like this, or very few events like this now, because he hates lunch. He won't do lunch, which is very disconcerting. When he does have to lunch, and you're sitting next to him, there'll be an empty plate, and it's quite odd to sit there eating lunch next to a monarch who's eating nothing, but he doesn't eat lunch, which is slightly ironic, given that Queen Camilla is patron of a charity called The Big Lunch, and she does eat lunch, which is why you should probably come to your awards, Harry, even if you can't get him. A lot of tree planting, manic tree planting going on. There's a sort of joke in the royal household, where's the king? Oh, he's probably out planting a tree. No, he actually is. Round-the-clock tree planting. But it's a team. It is a team, and Queen Camilla is very much central to that. She is in charge of timekeeping. Everyone else is still a little nervous. Our courts haven't changed much since Shakespeare's time, you know, so everyone's trying to work out how it works, you know, what upsets people, what doesn't. Queen Camilla can cut straight through all that, so if things are running over, if he's talking too long in a walkabout or chatting too long to a mayor, and everyone's looking at her watches and a bit nervous, she is the one who will go up, and she uses the sharp edge of her handbag. I've seen her do it, just gently in the small of his bag, and everything moves on seamlessly. She is, I'm going to quote a little bit from my book about her, because she reminds me of someone else. I wrote, "Her resolute determination not to be the star of the show, but the supporting act, the cheerful adherence to the Churchillian doctrine of KBO, keep buggering on, the ability to inject a remedial note of levity into a stifling situation, the deep love of books, and visceral attachment to the armed forces, the default use of plain speak over jargon, they were all the hallmarks of the consort to the previous monarch." And I think that is very much true of her. We are at a literary lunch. I think we should recall the fact that, you know, she is literature, and the written word is very important to her. I mean, her list of organisations in this regard are the National Literacy Trust, the Commonwealth Essay Prize, the Queen's Reading Room, Book Aid International, the Royal Society of Literature. She now has her own literary festival. All done in a very practical, unshowy way, but she is a great ally in the world of books. She's also the patron of the UK Vineyards Association and the daughter of a wine merchant. So I think it's safe to say she really is one of us. She's not the only one, of course, in this team. In my book, I go into some details.
Talking to the Princess Royal about the that extraordinary journey, the Queen's final journey, which I'm sure you all saw as the coffin, the Queen left Balmoral, came down through the glens and through those little country lanes, and gradually the crowds build and build and build.
And she was fascinating about it because I love incredibly moving scenes. I mean, some of you will have seen the tractors of Aberdeenshire dipping their shovels in homage, like the cranes along the Thames for Churchill. And at one point, fascinating and very moving, people on horseback grinding alongside the coffin as it went down the A90 through to Perth. And the crowds were so big, the Princess Royal told me, that it was a 6-hour journey, and she had a bottle of water and a few snacks in the car, but she said, I just couldn't touch them, because it would have looked very disrespectful. I mean, kind of a princess sort of necking a bottle of water in a funeral cortege. She said the only point in the entire 6-hour journey where she could actually take a drink of water was crossing the Forth Bridge. It was the only moment there were not vast crowds looking on. Also in the book, I mean, the extraordinary story of the last hours of the Queen, the details of her last red box. The hair's still at the back of my neck when I think about it. The memo that is now lodged in the Royal Archives, chronicling those last hours. An extraordinary story. People like the Earl Marshal. I mean, everybody wanted to tell me about they wanted to pay their own tribute to the late Queen because they felt so powerfully moved and proud to have played a part. But the Earl Marshal telling me about the problem with the funeral procession between the pace of the Grenadier Guards and the pace of the naval ratings meant that it was about a half-hour gap between the gun carriage getting to where it was supposed to be. It didn't matter. None of us noticed. It was the same with the coronation. Fantastic details about the coronation. Talking to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who was terrified he was going to put the crown on the wrong way around. And for weeks, he'd be marching around the house. He had this special mantra, because the St. Edmund's crown had a square jewel at the front and an oval jewel at the back, otherwise they will look exactly the same. And he literally marched around the house every day going, square front, oval back, square front, oval back, until he mastered it. Penny Mordaunt told me about the inside story of being the lady with the sword. She actually had two swords, said that the key to it all was to not put your heels on until the last minute. And there are in there, there's plenty on the younger generations. Yes, I touched on the Sussexes. I'm afraid I have not gone in the same sort of detail as Spare. There are no stories about broken dog bowls or frostbitten extremities. But there is, I hope, a very pertinent portrait of the future William V, who will be every bit as dutiful and diligent as the current king, even if it's a case of AC/DC and the Chemical Brothers rather than Wagner, but the thought is the same. There's plenty of history in there. I'm not even going to get into it now because Harry wants me to stop, but the Royal Archives yielded up all sorts of wonderful details about the 1953 coronation, but I think what we draw from the events of the last year and a half is that this is an institution in which the entire world has a very great interest. They want to be part of it. When these moments happen, the world wanted to come and pay tribute to Elizabeth II. They wanted to come to the coronation of Charles III because they wanted to witness the manifestation of an extraordinary piece of continuity. It is, I think, why we're extremely lucky to have the constitutional monarchy we have. and I hope this book explains why. Anyway, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you all so much, Robert, and thanks so much to all of you for coming today and for all our three distinguished.
You have been listening to the Oldie Podcast. Please share this episode. Look out for the Oldie Magazine subscription offer on our website www.theoldie.co.uk. Thank you and good luck.